Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Steve Zipperstein, National Jewish Book Award winner, author of Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. The holiday of Purim is coming up Wednesday night and Thursday, and it's time to get ready for it. So what does that exactly mean? While Purim is the silliest Jewish holiday, and in many ways the most fun, it's often neglected by adults as being just a kid's festival. That's a shame. Because the truth is, we need our religious life to be both serious and meaningful and fun, if not always at the same time. Judaism's always understood this, and it's incorporated into its annual calendar both the overwhelming seriousness of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and 6 months later, the ridiculous frivolity of Purim, the Feast of Esther. In a subtle way, it's chosen to make them polar opposites, twin festivals almost exactly half a year apart, with completely reversed traditions and practices. The parallels, or rather the reversals, are fascinating to note. Beginning with their placement on the calendar, they include food, dress, music, and seriousness. On Yom Kippur we fast, while on Purim we feast. On Yom Kippur we are to be deadly serious, while on Purim we are to revel and be as silly as possible. On Yom Kippur we dress in all white, while on Purim we dress in costumes of every color and construction. On Yom Kippur we pray all day, but on Purim we perform plays and parodies, have carnivals and celebrations, play games of chance. On Yom Kippur we are not to drink at all, not even water. On Purim we're commanded to drink alcohol ad delo yada, until we can't tell the difference between the evil Haman and the good Mordechai. On Yom Kippur there's music of great power and sanctity, like Kol Nidre. On Purim there is, oh, today we'll merry, merry be. If holidays were human beings, Yom Kippur would be Mother Teresa. Purim would be Charlie Sheen. These holidays couldn't be any more different, and both still be Jewish. Yet oddly, the mystics saw in Purim a similarity to Yom Kippur. They noted that Yom Kippur, called in Hebrew Yom HaKippurim, can be translated, loosely, as the day like Purim. And not only Kabbalists saw it this way, so did the noted anti-mystic, the Vilna Gaon. The reasoning of these great minds on this subject is surely complex. As one rabbi wrote, we would assume that Yom Kippur is the greater of the 2 days, but in one sense, Purim is even greater. It's easier to achieve spiritual elevation on a day like Yom Kippur, when we pray and have no time for forbidden activities like gossip or getting angry. By fasting, the soul achieves dominance over the body. But on Purim, in our state of rambunctious drunkenness, it is much harder to maintain our human dignity, says the rabbi. No kidding. As Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov writes, if one attains holiness through affliction and another attains holiness through indulgence, who is the greater of the two? It may be said that the one who attains holiness through indulgence is greater, for the attainment of holiness through indulgence requires an infinitely greater degree of striving and effort. In this way, the challenge of Purim is greater. Literally translated, Yom HaKippurim is only a day like Purim. Okay. Maybe they were drinking when they wrote that. Frankly, I don't buy it. To me, Purim is much more a reflection that people need humor and joy, at least as much as they need serious introspection. Purim comes to teach us that even the Holy Blessed One, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, likes a good party now and then. Like all the other springtime festivals of every tradition, whether called Mardi Gras, Spring Fling, Carnival, or Rodeo, Purim is a lot of fun, a great way to usher in the end of winter with a wild, over-the-top, rambunctious celebration. Inhibitions are out and revelry for one night and day is in. It's as though we've been good for so long we need to let down our hair, change our clothes, really celebrate. There's a 9-word summary for every Jewish festival from Hanukkah through Purim to Pesach. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. On Purim we add, and drink. Pure, irresponsible fun, right? But there's also something more profound going on at Purim than just a good, unwholesome time. There's a famous joke that says on Purim we Jews dress up and pretend to be non-Jews, while on Yom Kippur we dress up and pretend to be Jews. Purim reminds us that Judaism, our own Judaism, your Judaism, can be, should be enjoyable and meaningful, that being Jewish is a gift and a blessing and a rollicking good time. So, no matter how old or young you are, if you have or don't have kids with you still, or at all, come to Purim this year. It's Wednesday evening, this Wednesday evening, March 20th. My own congregation, Beit Simcha, the House of Joy itself here in Tucson, will revel in wild, raucous fun. A friendly Megillah reading, complete with costumes for adults and kids, the spectacularly delicious Hamantaschen pastries of all kinds, kid-friendly fun, special beverages for adults, and all the joy that comes for this Purim festival of absolute celebration. To get us into a Purim mood, here's Paul Zim singing La Yehudim Haita Ora V'Simcha. The Jews of Persia and the Purim story had light and joy. May it always be so for us.
Layhudim haita ora, layhudim haita ora, layhudim haita ora, besimcha besasam bikar. Layhudim haita ora, layhudim haita ora, layhudim haita ora, besimcha besasam bikar. Ken, ken, tiela.
That was Paul Zim's La Yehudim Haita Ora for Purim this Wednesday night and Thursday, March 20th and 21st. Our guest this morning is one of the most prominent Judaic studies professors in the world, Steve Zipperstein, National Jewish Book Award winner, author of the multi-award-winning new book Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History. He'll explain why studying Jewish history in depth shows us that a lot of what we think we know about our history isn't really right, and what we can learn from it that helps shape our understanding in this complicated world today. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Steve Zipperstein, one of the most prominent Jewish academics, I would say, in the world. And his book is a fascinating view of anti-Semitism, Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History. Has been nominated for a number of major prizes. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So this seems like the kind of subject for a book that nobody really wants to write.
There may be a definition of academic writing. But go on.
Yes, quite possibly. What prompted you to re-examine this most notorious episode in all of Jewish history?
Yeah, I don't know that it was the most notorious episode. It becomes among the most infamous in contemporary Jewish history, despite the fact that far fewer Jews are killed in this pogrom than in subsequent pogroms, and yet it becomes the emblem of Jewish violence in many ways before the Holocaust. It was the interplay between it was a vicious attack, certainly, but 2 years later on the streets of Odessa, just about 100 miles east of Kishinev, some 600 to 1,000 Jews are killed, and Odessa does not become the emblem of violence in the Jewish imagination. It was the interplay between the relative smallness of this act of this violence and the way in which it ended up resonating in Jewish memory, in non-Jewish memory, in anti-Semitic memory, having such an impact that it had, in many ways, a direct bearing on the creation of the NAACP a few years later that intrigued me. I started, as I mentioned at the beginning of the book, I signed a contract with a trade publisher to write a cultural history of Russian East European Jewry from the late 18th century to the present. And then while working on the Kishinev pogrom, which was to be just a small part of that book, I came to realize that if I was able to tell this particular story well, I would tell a singularly important story. And that's why I spent the time and effort in doing this.
You make an interesting point about the word pogrom itself. Was it familiar before Kishinev? It certainly becomes intimately tied to that awful experience.
Yeah, before Kishinev, and this is clear when one looks at the press in French and German and in English, the term is just one of a medley of terms used to describe both anti-Jewish and non-anti-Jewish violence. It comes to be understood in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom, as a government-sponsored or coordinated attack on Jews. And in large measure, it comes to be understood in those terms because of the surfacing of a letter signed by the Minister of Interior, Pleve, that surfaces a few weeks after the pogrom. It's printed in the Western press, that essentially has Pleve state. It's a letter to the Governor General of Bessarabia, the province that Kishinev is located in at the southwestern part of Russia, not to interfere when there's an attack on Jews. And it turns out the letter's a forgery. And in no small measure, the belief that this letter was accurate, we don't know who forged it, the belief that this letter was accurate had a decisive impact on ensuring that there was relatively unrestricted Jewish immigration to the United States until really just after the First World War. No doubt the authors of the letter believed that they were telling the truth and that this truth was essentially hidden, but at the same time, the words attributed to Pleve were not accurate.
Fascinating. And I wonder how many of us owe our safe and secure residence in the United States to that forgery. We will continue with Professor Steve Zipperstein when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, events, and holidays this spring, established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Beit Simcha is dedicated to create a vibrant community, striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills. Beit Simcha is at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us this Wednesday for Purim at 6:30 p.m., a Megillah reading and raucous fun. And then Friday night and every Friday night at Skyline and Campbell, Shabbat services begin at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah study, and then services start at 9 a.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, Purim, our great religious school, and Torah Tikes program, our incredible array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its joyful and exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about some of the aspects of Israel that people don't know too well. The development of the IDF, how it wasn't so professional or courageous at first, and it really had to grow into that role. The rule of law has always been central to Israel. It's a democratic country. It doesn't have a constitution, but it has a very strong fabric of law going all the way up to the Supreme Court, and nobody is above the law. Mm-hmm. And that's been proven at the highest levels. That's sometimes a difficult lesson, isn't it?
Right. So, first of all, you're right. It's difficult. You know, as a member of the community, as a citizen, as someone who cares about the state of Israel, I was here at the United States when... things such as Olmert, who was our prime minister, went to jail, you know, for corruption. Major corruptions, right? I mean, and then when our president, Katsav, was sent to jail because of different sexual, you know, incidents and raping.
Literally, rape.
And he went to jail, you know, and it's not a comfortable situation where, as a Jewish educator, when I have to go and speak with high school students and knowing that they can read and know what happens, and what is your obligation? Should you talk about it, or you shouldn't not talk about it? Or should they know only about good things that happen in Israel? And I really think that our responsibility is to share the truth. And even when it's not comfortable, it's a sign of strength, because no one is above the law. You know, I woke up today in the morning, or yesterday, when I read what happens in Israel now with our current Israeli Prime Minister,
right,
Benjamin Netanyahu, and again, it's uncomfortable. It's a sad thing. You know, you have people in his party, members of his party, or supporters of the party, that whatever he's going to do are going to say it's nonsense and it doesn't matter, and he's a great prime minister. And you have those who are going to say, look, I'm not going to be in a party or support a party if he's indicted, or if he's guilty,
convicted,
right? Yeah. So again, it's you have those who are on the left, who are going to be happy, and there are going to be those who are going to be sad, because it doesn't matter if they support him or don't support him. He's our leader, and he's an elected one.
You know, it's funny. I don't think anybody should be happy when a high level leader is convicted of, in this case, corruption, not been convicted, but indicted for corruption. It seems like it looks bad. You know, we have a phrase in Yiddish, Shanda for the Goyim, you know, like it looks bad to the other nations, the people of the world.
I agree.
The truth is, it's an affirmation of a society in which there is a rule of law, in which there's a Supreme Court that's above political corruption. And even when, you know, it shows bad sides of your society, it really means it's an affirmation of democracy working the way it's supposed to work.
You know, the commander of the police that was very strong, you know, about sharing his opinion, was selected right, by the prime minister.
Right.
The legal advisor that is now saying in a few hours he's going to, you know, talk to right, the public in Israel, he was selected by the Israeli prime minister.
Right.
You know, these are people that, even though he selected them, are very honest and work hard to pursue justice.
Well, we trust that justice will be done, and it's better to have a society. Look, there's going to be human beings that make mistakes in every society. You want them to be able to be brought to justice, mm-hmm. and you want to clean up what's wrong.
I agree.
Thanks so much, Amir.
You're welcome.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about memory over the last few weeks, and we're off mic. We were talking about the fact that the way that we remember those who have died is the same for Jews everywhere in the world. For 7 days after we sit Shiva, we have Yahrzeit on the year anniversary of the death. We say Kaddish. We have the celebration is wrong, but the commemoration of Yizkor 4 times a year, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuot, when we all remember those who have died. Then we're not remembering the same people, right? We're remembering the people in our own lives, but it's the same in any Jewish community in the world.
Right. I mean, until now, when we've been talking about memory, we've been talking about national episodes, whether it be the Holocaust or the Exodus from Egypt or the near extinction of the Jewish community in Persia, whatever.
Right. That are not, add to that
right,
too.
Right. Not like personal, individual remembrances. But there, too, there are a lot of commandments and a lot of practices that involve remembering a significant individual in fairly structured ways. As you just pointed out, there's the first 7 days of mourning, and then there's the Shloshim, and then there's...
Right. After, right.
There's all this stuff, and the question is, okay, we all see everybody in a different way, so we obviously, when they're gone, we remember them in a different way, and how does this structure, or does it, in fact, succeed in helping us to remember, to process the memories, to learn from the memories? I mean, you quoted before the Baal Shem Tov, saying that memory leads to redemption. But sometimes memory is like a hamster wheel. You just keep going around and around, and you make no progress. You never get off it. You're stuck. So how can memory be redemptive?
You know, for us, I think memory is redemptive when we find ways to apply the qualities of a person. You know, I don't think that the best way to remember is to idealize somebody that we love. I think the best way is to see that which was great about them and then to bring that into our lives and live that. And, you know, that's a very rabbinic answer, but it'd be the same thing if you were here or in Australia or South Africa or Israel, wherever it is. Those life experiences and lessons are the same. And I think in that, for the Baal Shem Tov, redemption was, how do we live our lives to honor those memories?
Right. I had a very interesting experience along these lines once in Mexico, of all places, where I was visiting a friend who was a fairly young father with 3 children under the age of 10. And he sat me down roughly a year after my father died and said, Tom, I met your dad. He was a great guy. And obviously, you think he was a great father. My father abandoned me when I was 3 months old, so I never really had a father. What do you think it takes to make a good father? What were the characteristics of your dad that made him such a good dad? And I thought about it. I tried to answer the question both with specific anecdotes and general qualities. And at the end, this conversation, this act of remembering my father at my friend's request, was redemptive for me, because my friend said, you know, there's a lot more of your dad in you than you think there is.
Oh, that's sweet.
It was very nice and very redemptive.
So memory can be redemption in a different way than we may expect. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
There's a reason why SiriusXM Satellite Radio plays Rabbi Bob Alper's comedy bits every day, sandwiched between people like Bob Newhart and Jerry Seinfeld. Bob's unique background. He's an ordained rabbi who served congregations for 14 years and has a doctorate from Princeton Theological Seminary, and that prepared him well for a 30-year comedy career with wonderfully unique material presented in a way that's intelligent, sophisticated, and guaranteed 100% clean. Bob Alper is much funnier than Rabbi Sam Kohan, and I can testify to that. It'll be 90 minutes of nonstop laughter with Rabbi Bob Alper Sunday, March 31st at 7 p.m. when the world's only practicing clergyman doing stand-up comedy intentionally comes to Tucson, a program open to all in the community and universally enjoyable. Join us in a charitable benefit for Congregation Beit Simcha on Erev April Fool's Day when Rabbi Bob Alper entertains in a one-night-only show, 3001 East Skyline Drive at Congregation Beit Simcha, the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell. For tickets, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675, $20 in advance, $25 at the door. Sunday night, March 31st at 7 p.m., go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675 for a wonderful night of Jewish comedy with Rabbi Bob Alper. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. There is, by the way, a Purim tradition of telling truly awful jokes, much worse than the ones we typically tell, even here on Too Jewish. For example, what was Queen Esther's royal gown made out of? Polyester. Or Avram calls out, "Waiter, waiter, I'm in a hurry. Will my matzah be long?" And the waiter says, "No, sir, it'll be square." Anyway, we reserve the right to use our old Jewish joke of the week segment for better material. Well, you'll be the judge. To wit, one of life's greatest mysteries is how the boy who wasn't good enough to marry your daughter can be the father of the smartest grandchild in the whole world. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Rotem Rappaport and Rondena Code, representing the Weintraub Israel Center Young Israelis here in America. Boker Tov and an early Chag Purim Sameach.
Boker Tov, Chag Sameach.
So Purim is the happiest holiday in Jewish tradition. There's really nothing serious about it. And while it's fun here and it's thought of as a kid's holiday in Israel, it's insane. Tell us a little bit about your experience of Purim. I mean, insane in a good way, really.
Yeah, so I celebrated, because I'm only 18, I celebrated as a kid.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So as a kid, we were dressed up in our schools. They do like big carnivals in our schools, all this kind of special things, like performances and costume contest, and there's something really special in our school that is like a really big, like a Purim week, which is really, really big, and it's special to our school in Israel.
People dress up every day of the week of Purim, or?
In a lot of schools, they do that. Like, yeah. They do, it's kind of
so
like
a
theme.
Right, you need like a whole array of costumes just for the week in school.
Yeah, they do like themes like pajama day and like, I don't know,
backwards
like boys,
day,
girls day, and, yeah, where
boys
girls dress up as
girls, girls dress up as boys.
Yes, and like all this kind of stuff, like collar day, all this. But we do something like unique, special, but it's like really big like thing.
Only Jews could take an attempted genocide and turn it into a week of fun costumes and ridiculousness.
Yes.
How about you guys? What did you guys do, Ron, besides dressing up?
So, Rotem and I actually went to the same school.
Ah, so you did the same thing.
Yes, but this week that she's talking about, it's really, really big. I don't think like even other schools in Israel have that something. They do have something similar in some schools, but it's not the same thing. I mean, we have like big groups of kids and you have to cheer for your team and you have colors and it's like the whole week you build like really big projects around the school
and you
sleep there. It's like really,
wow.
It's amazing. Yeah. And it's kind of like a contest. So it's really awesome. Every year I lose my voice.
Yes, yes. It's almost like camp for a week.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like,
it's like
overnight camp here in America. Like where you're
exactly.
And if it's a Jewish camp, you have, you know, a Maccabia or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They have contests something. And silly contests and all
right.
kinds of things. So obviously there's also Hamantashen Oz Nehaman, which everybody eats the whole
wow,
week.
Wow, my God.
The so best good. Food ever created
right.
in the history
yes.
of humanity, unless it's the latke, which, you know, okay, it's close. what's your favorite flavor of Hamantashen? Does anybody make anything interesting?
like chocolate. I think, yes. And I don't know if it's that popular here, but in Israel we have poppy seeds filling inside.
Yeah, mun.
Terrible. I don't know what they're creating.
I love it. I think you're wrong.
I think, like, really? Okay. Maybe it's just me. Sorry.
Another really big thing is mishloche manot.
Right.
And
so let's explain shaloch manos or mishloach manot.
Okay, so it's like a mitzvah, right? To actually to bring things to the
gifts,
right?
Gifts of food, right?
Right. So we do it kind of like we call it hagamad ve'anak. So it's like every day of the week you give like a little bit, like something like a chocolate or a candy to like a different person without them knowing, and then at the actual day of Purim you bring like a whole basket of things. And it's really nice just because it's like tradition.
Right.
And you get, usually you have hamantaschen in it and like chocolate and I don't know, maybe like a note from that person.
Something nice, like fun for every day.
Exactly. And everyone, it gets from everyone and everyone gives to everyone. So
right.
It's
so
like,
everybody has plenty to eat, lots of junk food around the whole
day. Yes.
A special day for everyone. Listen, Chag Purim Sameach. Also, I should note, it's traditional to give special charity, Matanot Le'Avyonim, the time of Purim. Not just Mishloach Manot, but you know, food gifts to help people. Everybody should enjoy Purim.
Yeah. Right.
Especially you two.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion is second in the book of Leviticus, Tzav, the section that establishes the rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan, and in the temple in Jerusalem. There are many different types of sacrifices commanded here, burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. But one group of sacrificial offerings stands out, the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. And among this higher category of offerings, one in particular rises even higher, the Zevach HaTodah, the thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of thanksgiving to God that they're quoted in the Talmud saying that when the Messiah comes, all sacrifices will have completed their mission. All will be discontinued with one exception only, the thanksgiving offering. That sacrifice will last forever. Even in a perfect world, we must remember to give thanks, to be grateful for what we have. We do well to remember that gratitude for what we have is both the most essential of all religious motivations and the hardest to keep in mind. If we can each take a moment today to write, email, text, or phone our thanks to someone who is important in our lives, we'll begin to renew this great commitment of our Torah portion. We have so much for which to be grateful. And if we can also each take a moment to thank God for what we have and to be more conscious of those who have less, we'll begin to make this a better world. For thanksgiving should not lead us to complacency, but instead to humility and gratitude. On this week of Shabbat Tzav, let us give thanks for what we have, for health and happiness, for the freedom to worship, for all the wonderful goodness God has placed in this world we share. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Steve Zipperstein, National Jewish Book Award winner, author of Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History, will tell us who actually wrote the terrible anti-Semitic forgery, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and explain that pogroms were not created or supported by the Tsarist Russian administration, and many other facts of history that have importance right now. Find out what they are when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, the IDF, the Israeli army, uncovered an entire Hezbollah terrorist infrastructure on the Syrian side of the Golan Heights. The terror cell, dubbed by Hezbollah as the Golan File, is still in its early stages, but already has stockpiled intelligence and weapons and recruited operatives. It was able to gain a foothold in the area after troops loyal to Syrian President Bashar Assad recaptured the area from rebels last summer. All the groups and individuals operating in the infrastructure of the Golan portfolio or file are hidden from the eyes and knowledge of each other, as well as of the local population, including the Syrian regime itself, the IDF says. The leadership of this group can act in secrecy in the region without fear of the regime's recognition of its infrastructure. Reportedly has been kept a secret even from the dictator Assad. This cell is led by Lebanese commanders, made up of Syrian mercenaries, many from local villages, and run by Abu Hussein Sajid, also known as Ali Musa Daktouk, who led Hezbollah's division in Iraq in 2006, was captured and jailed by American troops in 2007 for killing five U.S. soldiers. He was released 5 years later and worked for the next 6 years with Hezbollah's special forces before joining this new terror cell in the Golan. In other news from Israel, Israel's third largest bank will pay a $195 million fine after admitting it helped its customers avoid paying U.S. taxes. That fine was announced by the U.S. Justice Department. It's the result of a five-year investigation. Under the settlement, the bank, Mizrahi Tfachot, accepted responsibilities for the actions of former employees who acted in contravention of the policies of the bank and its management. At least that's what they say. The employees were not in senior management. They worked in private banking and customer relations between 2002 and 2012. The bank has also put in place a new tax and money laundering measures program. In a follow-up to a pretty awful story that comes from, of all places, Newport Beach, California, posters with Nazi symbols were hung around the campus of the same Southern California high school, whose students were filmed offering the Heil Hitler salute over a swastika made out of beer cups during a drinking game. 10 posters with Nazi symbols were discovered last weekend on the campus of Newport Harbor High School in Newport Beach and removed before students returned to school. Newport Beach police are investigating. The school's principal sent a message to parents after the posters were discovered. "Again, we condemn all acts of anti-Semitism and hate in all their forms," he wrote. "We'll continue to be vigilant with our stance and the care of our students and staff." Students and former students of this Newport High School and other area high schools played the drinking game at a weekend party earlier this month. Photographs of the swastika they made out of red plastic cups and students making Nazi salutes were posted on social media. The schools responded with a public forum, hosted Holocaust survivor Eva Schloss, stepsister of teenage Holocaust diarist Anne Frank, in meetings with the students involved. Versions of the drinking game, which pits teams of Jews against Nazis, wow, have been popular since at least 2016, when students at a Princeton high school in New Jersey were seen playing the game on social media. You know, at a time when anti-Semitic social media actions and this kind of thing, and hate speech, have been a huge focus of attention in America, including in Congress, we perhaps should be reminded that anti-Semitism remains much more socially acceptable in Europe. A Norwegian rapper who cursed Jews while performing at an event in Oslo promoting multiculturalism will not be charged with hate speech because his words may have been a criticism of Israel, the prosecutors said. Kaveh Kolardi said effing Jews on stage, I'm paraphrasing, at an event last year for which he was hired by the city to promote multiculturalism. Tor Axel Busch, Norway's director of public prosecutions, its attorney general in effect, rejected legal action last week. Pro-Israel activists had filed a police complaint, but it was dismissed. Busch rejected their appeal, explaining that whereas the rapper said something that seems to be targeting Jews, it can, however, also be said to express dissatisfaction with the policies of the State of Israel. At the concert, Kolardi wished Muslims a happy Eid al-Fitr holiday and acknowledged Christian listeners. He did not mention Israel, he just talked about effing Jews. June 10, 2018, 5 days before that concert, he wrote on Twitter, "Effing Jews are so corrupt." The pro-Israel group, MIFF, a Norwegian acronym for With Israel for Peace, which was involved in the initial complaint, called Bush's decision alarming because he finds ambiguity where there is none. And in England, just in time for Purim, the Leeds University Union voted against a motion calling on the British institution to fight anti-Semitism, prompting a university-wide referendum on the subject. Leeds University is the fifth largest university in the UK, has a total of more than 33,000 students. The draft motion submitted by the Leeds University Jewish Society to the student government called for the adoption of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. That definition includes some examples of anti-Israel vitriol, but states that criticism of Israel that is comparable to criticism of any other country does not constitute anti-Semitism. In the vote last week at a policy forum, the motion was two votes shy of the required number for adoption. 10 representatives voted in favor, only 5 against. University-wide referendum will probably fail. The Leeds Jewish Society is incredibly disappointed, it said. Critics of the anti-Semitism definition, adopted last year by the British government as its working definition of it, say it obstructs free speech. You know, the freedom to publicly direct hate speech against Jews. A freedom, apparently. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Steve Zipperstein is the Daniel Koshland Professor in Jewish Culture and History at Stanford. He has taught at universities all over the world and has published prominent books that have won the National Jewish Book Award and many other prizes. His book, Pogrom Kishinev and the Tilt of History, has not only been widely reviewed, but has been nominated for a number of prominent academic and literary awards. We started speaking about Pogrom and the impact of Kishinev. You, in your research, focus to a good deal in this book on perhaps the individual most prominently, responsible for the events that led to the Kishinev pogrom. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Yeah, Pavel Krushevan, I think, is who you're referring to.
Correct,
what,
yeah.
What I came to, I'll speak about him specifically in a moment, but what I came to realize, and by general consensus, historians of anti-Semitism concur with this, that by and large, hatred, hatred against Jews and others coalesces on the top. It's coalesced by ideologues, sometimes by political leaders. Kishinev was not known as a major center of anti-Jewish hatred, but in Kishinev lived people like Krushevan, who were among the most far-right haters of Jews in the Russian Empire. Krushevan ended up buying the one real newspaper in the region, eventually became a hate sheet accusing Jews of all sorts of things, including ritual murder. A ritual murder charge surfaced just before the pogrom. Mm-hmm. And it seems almost certain that he and a cluster of other allies both organized the pogrom and were at work on a document that eventually came to be called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion before the pogrom, and then rushed it into print shortly afterwards, published in a newspaper owned by Krushevan himself in Petersburg. I was able to fill out his story in ways previously inaccessible because shortly before finishing the book, I discovered in private hands his personal papers that had been, he died rather young of cancer at 49, gave his most embarrassing papers to a nephew. The nephew died in a psychiatric hospital. The papers ended up being in the hands of a Jew from Kishinev, which is what Kishinev is now called, after the fall of communism. He brought the papers to the States. I heard about him having something, visited him, and he handed them to me to help arrange for sale to an archive. And what I learned was that Krushevan, who's today considered in that same part of what was the former Soviet Union, Moldova. It's called the state of Moldova, just wedged between Romania and Ukraine.
Right.
He's largely considered to be a pioneer of anti-capitalism, anti-Westernization, anti-Semitism, and homophobia, was a closeted homosexual himself. I had I have access to his adolescent diary, where he speaks about having sex with a Cossack of the male persuasion and wishing to have been born a lady, as he puts it. He was considered to be the best situated and best supported anti-Semite at the time in Russia, and in fact, he went through serial bankruptcies. It's just an example of how once you dig under the surface in history, you discover things that would seem otherwise counterintuitive. It also appears to be accurate that while losing his mother at a very young age, his father, when he remarried a Jew who no doubt converted. His sister ran away with a Jew and moved to the United States. It's the sort of story that, had I written it as a novel, the fiction editor at my publisher, W.W. Norton, would have said, no, life isn't like this. and yet, life sometimes is.
Sometimes
like
is exactly like this.
One of the really, I guess, maybe the most horrifying part, in a way, in reading the book, has to do with the fact that a lot of these atrocities were perpetrated by people that the victims knew and knew very well and had lived among without fear, as friends even, and that this now seems to be a kind of a theme in these genocidal experiences. I don't know if genocide is the right word, but in these horrible violations. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, what I learned in addition, and I'll get to your question in a moment, is that at the same time, Jews fleeing attackers time and again felt perfectly comfortable running into the homes of non-Jewish neighbors, expecting protection, and they're being protected. So the event was horrific. I deal mostly in the book with the aftermath of the event and its impact on Jews and others. But one should remember this is a city of 110,000, and some 900 are arrested, 900 attackers, and the number 900 includes Jews who are engaged in self-defense. Right. So, but what was apparent to me from going through the various sources in Hebrew, Yiddish, Russian, and other languages is a phenomenon similar to the one described so brilliantly by Jan Gross in his book Neighbors, about an attack on Jews in a Polish town during the Second World War, that the interplay between familiarity and ferocity. And I can't explain this, and I'm not a psychologist, but this becomes apparent in account after account. A Jewish mother who's raped by a man who she had actually suckled as an infant. Jews who were shoemakers who repaired the shoes a few days earlier, perhaps a week earlier, of people who then attacked them with ferocity. And it is true, on the one hand, that there are many non-Jews who readily protect Jews at the risk of being attacked themselves. And this interplay between familiarity and ferocity is clearly a factor in Kishinev as it is elsewhere.
Bialik's poem about the Kishinev pogrom, I don't know how famous it is now, but it was world famous at the time, and it's an unbelievably moving, powerful...
In Israel, it remains.
Right. I mean, it's considered by many people the greatest work of Hebrew poetry since, I don't know, Yehuda Halevi or something.
Right.
It's really powerful, and it described it. I think it was incredibly influential in moving Jews from the traditional role of scholars, and when the pogrom came, you hid, to this new concept of the new Jew in Israel and Zionism.
It consolidates that myth. Jews did not necessarily hide, and as you know well, most Jews weren't scholars. I suspect as a congregational rabbi, you recognize that most Jews aren't scholars now.
I would never admit that to my congregation, of course.
But you've just admitted on radio.
Yes,
and,
I do.
but it consolidates a series of tropes, of notions about Jews that end up being very influential in Zionism. Part of what I argue, I juxtapose Chaim Nachman Bialik and his majestic poem, Bir Haragan, The City of Killing, with a contemporaneous a witness, a person who comes to Kishinev to report for the Hearst Press, a then very well-known journalist and political radical, Michael Davitt.
Right.
And I had access to the notes that he took during his stay. And on the one hand, Bialik does completely ignore incidents of Jewish self-defense.
Right,
which
and
he himself records.
Right.
Yeah, which he himself records in his own notes that he then sequesters away, and they're not published for many, many years. But he also, his charge that there are Jewish men, substantial numbers, who hide while their mothers, their sisters, their wives are raped, that charge ends up being substantiated not in the published work by Davitt, but in his private notes. And so what I suggested in the book was that clearly Bialik told only part of the truth, but he did include in the poem an aspect of reality that other published sources felt uncomfortable admitting. And what I suggested was that this was probably common knowledge at the time, but the sort of embarrassing news that a otherwise beleaguered people tend to sequester, a characteristic not only of Jews, but of all sorts of beleaguered people. There are all sorts of embarrassing aspects of any people's history. And perhaps those embarrassing aspects tend to be hidden more by people who feel beleaguered than others. In one of my book talks, I was asked probably the most unfriendly but very useful question I was asked was by this woman who turned to me and said, "Why should I believe what you're saying if everything you're saying contradicts everything my mother told me?"
Mm.
And it's a perfectly pertinent and powerful question, but in response, I thought of the statement of the great Polish poet Miłosz, who said something akin to, when a novelist is born into a family, the family is finished. Novelists, as well as historians, tell family secrets. And there seems something uneasy about what it is we do and what it is that novelists who write about the familiar territory do. And there's every reason for people to feel uneasy. But both novelists as well as historians feel that there's something really crucial about telling truths that are otherwise sequestered. And that is in and of itself something of a good working definition of what a historian does.
I want to thank Professor Steve Zipperstein for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History, and it's a great read in addition to being great history. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohine. Join us next Sunday. On Too Jewish, our guest will be comedian Rabbi Bob Alper, star of the Jewish Comedy Night at Congregation Beit Simcha on March 31st, an event you don't want to miss. It's Erev April Fool's Day. It'll be great fun. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Play out this morning comes from our pre-Purim musical preview. The festival is coming this Wednesday and Thursday, 6:30 p.m. at Congregation Beit Simcha here in Tucson, where I live. It's called Kichlot Yeni, a Sephardic melody from Tangier, located in Morocco, just across the strait from the Rock of Gibraltar and Spain. It's a clever medieval complaint about a host who serves watered-down wine on Purim. My friends, may you have a great Chag Sameach, a Purim filled with light and especially joy, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Kichlot yeni tereni, ציבורים ויחידו כשיזרים שבתו שירים כפישרים מלא מים מלא מים לחם לאוכל לחיתם מורך מחר לחיתם להתפגיל לפני המיותן מים
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.